Previously on the Tony Kornheiser Show.
What he should be doing is jumping into this with both feet and using his royal prerogatives to scold United.
Well, he doesn't need to because members of Congress already have.
Members of Congress are going to do that. And what the other thing is...
Do you think they'll drag this guy into Washington for a hearing? Because everybody likes that.
Oh, yes.
Big hearing, yell at him.
Yeah.
If I'm on the Transportation Committee, I'm saying, get this guy in there right now.
Yeah.
I get TV time.
Yeah. Let's make mincemeat out of Oscar Munoz. Let's do that. You know what? Let's bring in Oscar De La Hoya to beat him up.
This is General George Washington, and you're listening to the Tony Kornheiser Show.
All righty then, plausibly live from a third floor location in Chevy Chase, Maryland, that I know about and you don't. We're on the air with Gene McManus and Gary Braun. The birthday boy, Michael Kornheiser, is with us.
You remembered.
I do. It's his birthday.
Happy birthday.
Nigel is going to run the board and
do
news.
Where's the cake?
Later in the
show. Where's the cake?
Later in the show, Ann Hornaday will review movies. There's two ways to begin this. There's the local way to talk about the Washington Capitals essentially winning their first round series last night by spotting Toronto 2-0 lead at home and then winning the game ultimately in overtime. Or the national view, which is to talk about the death of Dan Rooney, the patriarch of the Pittsburgh Steelers, who took over basically around 1969 from his father, Art Rooney. Art Rooney, you know, the great, lovable, fat guy with a cigar. That's how he's viewed all the time. Dan Rooney ran that team from 1969 on and ran it officially from 1975 on for about 25 years and then has given his son, Art II, Art II, control of the team for the last X amount of years. There's just nobody better as in terms of this show to talk about this one particular aspect of Dan Rooney, not the football aspect, but the Pittsburgh aspect of Dan Rooney than Howard Fineman, who grew up in this period of time when the Steelers were very bad and then very, very great. And this is at the feet of Dan Rooney. And if I'm not mistaken, didn't you tell me, Howard, that you were at an Irish-American dinner recently with Dan Rooney in Pittsburgh?
Well, I was there with the Rooney. This is about this was right on the weekend of St. Patrick's Day,
mm-hmm.
and I'd been invited up there to speak to the dinner. Dan Rooney wasn't there. He was sick. He was quite ill, and this was the first time I think since the Irish-American Foundation had been started by Dan Rooney and by a guy named Tony O'Reilly who was the CEO of Heinz at the time about 20-25 years ago. They started it, and their Irish American Foundation dinners all over the country. Now they're in Boston, Chicago, Pittsburgh, elsewhere, and they raise money for poor kids in Ireland and to do peace enhancing things there, and so that was one of his many things. He wasn't there, but his presence kind of hung over the entire room of 800 or 900 people in the big fancy club at Heinz Field. I sat at the dinner with Art II,
okay,
and with his wife Gretchen and their kids. Almost all of their kids were there, and it was an honor. The Rooneys are the kind of unofficial royal family of Pittsburgh, and for good reason. And Art II is a lovely guy. His wife Gretchen is great. The kids are wonderful, and the emerging leader of the next generation was at the table, and his name is Dan Rooney III. He played quarterback at Dartmouth. He's going to business school. He will end up running the team eventually. It's really an amazing story. But everybody was concerned about Dan because he wasn't there.
He became, obviously, late in his life, the ambassador to Ireland. He had been, I watched all the pieces, he had been a lifelong Republican, and then he voted for Barack Obama, which sort of, what is interesting to me is the pictures of him with Obama, and then Obama naming him ambassador to Ireland. Art Rooney has probably done more for diversity in sports on a managerial level than anyone ever. Dan Rooney. Art Rooney? I meant Dan Rooney. With what is called the Rooney Rule, which is the thing that will live on after him, and is nobody says anything other than this is very good. It doesn't achieve all the aims as quickly as people like, but it gets people into the mix who would not necessarily be in the mix. And I'm wondering, what kind of background does Dan Rooney come from, and is that a sort of expected part of his character?
Well, in his case, yes. He grew up in an area of Pittsburgh called the North Side, which is, by the way, where Heinz Field and PNC Park are now, on the north side of the Allegheny River. And that was a more mixed area, more a racially mixed neighborhood than a lot of the others in Pittsburgh, because just historical accident, that's the way it was. He grew up playing over there in ball fields in integrated teams. He attended Duquesne University Catholic School in Pittsburgh, which was a pioneer in recruiting and playing black players.
Sure, Cy Green, Cy Hugo Green.
Cy Hugo Green was one of the first great African-American basketball stars in mainstream college basketball. So he had that tradition going for him. And also, Pittsburgh had and still has a great newspaper that comes out of the African-American community called the Pittsburgh Courier, which was one of the great African-American newspapers in the country. They had a sports writer named Bill Nunn. And Bill Nunn was an expert in black college football. He knew everything about all the obscure African-American colleges, historically black colleges all over the country. And when Dan Rooney got directly involved in management of the team, now he'd started as the water boy at the age of five, he had the brilliant idea of hiring Bill Nunn away from the Pittsburgh Courier newspaper and making him a scout and making him part of the draft team. So I don't know the whole list of players, but there are a whole list of great Steelers, including several in the Hall of Fame, who came out of these colleges that most of the rest of the NFL ignored. And he didn't care about color. Dan Rooney did not care about color. He cared about one thing, winning. That's all he cared about. And when they hired Joe, when they drafted Mean Joe Green, that not the drafting of Bradshaw, the drafting of Mean Joe Green the year before that, which was Dan Rooney was directly involved in with Chuck Knoll, really was the foundation stone of the Steelers. So Rooney came by his views on his colorblindness honestly and not late in the game. And then in 2008, after Caroline Kennedy and then Ted Kennedy had endorsed Barack Obama, Dan Rooney, who had really never said boo about politics and who was a Republican from the old days of Pennsylvania, where the Republicans were the progressives going back a century, he came out and publicly endorsed Barack Obama. And I can tell you that that was probably one of the five or six most important endorsements that Barack Obama got, and Barack Obama paid him back by making him ambassador to Ireland.
The Rooneys and the Maras are the legendary families of the, and the Halases, obviously, the legendary families of the NFL, not, for example, the Irsays at this point. The one thing I'm interested in is it is written and said that it was Dan Rooney who picked Chuck Knoll. Dan Rooney would have been a very young man, as was Chuck Knoll.
Yes.
The coaches, they've only had three.
Right.
And the
Since
coaches,
1969, they've had three.
The coaches are always in their 30s when they're picked.
Yes.
Cower and Tomlin in their 30s. How did he land on Knoll? Because that changed the franchise more than any other thing.
I don't know the answer to that question. I know, according to the New York Times obit, which was pretty good. By the way, the Post obit was just dreadful.
It's small and not worthy.
Dreadful.
Yeah.
What are they thinking? They don't know anything. Anyway, the Times was much better. The Times obit says that they interviewed Joe Paterno. I don't know if that's right. I think that would not have been characteristic. I don't know how they got to Knoll exactly. It might have been some possible cultural connection, even a religious connection. I don't really know. That's a key fact. But Knoll, and I met Knoll several times, and Knoll was a broad-gauge guy, as you know. He looked fierce there on the sidelines, but he was like a wine connoisseur. He read every history book on the shelf. He was, and also quiet in the way of Dan Rooney. Now, the few times I met Dan Rooney were usually on game days, because I would go up to playoff games and so on up there, because I know a lot of people there. You did not want to talk to Dan Rooney on game day. If you got in his way, he's a little guy, but he'd practically run you over. But he was quiet. He was rarely said much in public. You know, he made the modern NFL, because he convinced his dad to to let the Steelers move over to the old AFL, which helped.
That's right. They were an NFL team.
Meant the merger of the NFL and the AFL.
So I think Cleveland did that. And
Cleveland and Pittsburgh.
And was there one other? Or just
I don't
those
know.
Two?
I think it was just. Okay. It might have been just those two. But anyway, he operated behind the scenes almost all the time. He and his wife set up a prize called the Rooney Prize, which is for young aspiring Irish writers. They've directed hundreds of millions of dollars through this foundation over to Ireland. You know, he was ambassador. He was the first ambassador to visit all 32, I think, counties in Ireland. He held town halls in every county. I mean, and he was a devout Catholic. He went to Mass every morning at a church in downtown Pittsburgh. His devotion to his family was complete. I mean, this is if sports does something good in American society, the Rooneys, to me, mm-hmm. in football, are the expression of it.
Thank you, Howard. Go back to your Intergalactia now, but this was great.
I'm lost on the north side of Pittsburgh.
Howard Fineman, boys and girls. And that's the beginning of the open of the show, because I think that the Rooneys are worth that. Their contribution to the NFL, their backing of Pete Rozelle, their backing of Paul Tagliabue, their sense of fairness, everybody talks about this all the time. So we'll go from the national, from the macro to the micro, and talk about the Capitals. And I basically have said everything I was going to say, which is the Capitals, they won the series last night. They were down 2-0 at home. Justin Williams got both goals to tie it up. Tim Wilson scored in the overtime. The series is over. Do you agree or disagree?
Sure. I mean, I would have said the series was over before last night's game, but at about 9:30 last night, I may have felt differently. But I didn't watch that game. I know Gene saw the whole game. I just saw the end.
I didn't watch it.
The part I saw, and I saw the end of the third period in overtime. I wasn't watching it with tremendous confidence, and I can't help but feel like, well, yeah, this is just the setup for the ultimate disappointment.
For the big crash.
I think they win the game 2-4-1.
Well, I'm not saying that they lose this series.
Right.
But it's just always such a, I'll say, fun ride with them. I'll put a rosy spin on it and say a fun ride.
I am not brimming with the confidence you're brimming with.
Oh, I am.
After
he's supremely confident.
The reason I'm supremely confident is because in the next round, they will not face one of the best teams in the Eastern Conference and one of the best teams in the league, either Pittsburgh or Columbus. The number two team, Pittsburgh. The number four team, Columbus. One of them is going out at the hands
Let's
of the other.
Let's not get out ahead of our skis on this one. Last night, they faced an eighth seed. And in the first period, they looked like the number eight seed. They couldn't do squat.
Okay. But they won the game. They came back. They got the last three goals.
Okay. But are you brimming with confidence that they won it in overtime?
To me,
at home, yes, game one,
you have to. Yes, I am, because they could have lost that game and then all the doom would have rained down.
Oh, yeah.
They scored the last three goals at home. They had that really tough game that they didn't expect that early, and they won.
Wake
that
up
game.
Call.
They
Tony,
won that game.
Tony's subscribing to the wake up call theory.
Okay.
Now they get a free lesson.
I'm just
looking at these young.
And Ovechkin didn't have to do it because Ovechkin doesn't do it.
Yeah. The flip side is you have a young team who realizes that they can now skate with the Capitals, have made the Caps nervous.
Right.
And whereas you thought the Pittsburgh-Columbus series might tire out one of those teams.
Definitely.
What happens if Pittsburgh skates through that opening round and the Caps play this young, hungry team and they
or
come
six.
Out tired?
They're not. It's going to be a five-game series at the most.
Well, okay. I don't know if you guys saw. I think Trotz is going to sit Ovechkin and Holtby just to rest them.
Yes.
So, you know.
So you're... Not as confident.
Well, how can you be confident? Confident. I mean, it's the playoffs. It's an entirely different season.
If they won 4-0, I might have a little more zest in my description of the game, but I'm not there yet.
I mean, a Chicken Little could say, you know, they had a great season. Now the playoff season started, and here they were fighting for struggling for air.
But they won.
Yeah, they won the game.
Also, Tom Wilson, I believe you meant to say
Tim. I don't know who he is.
It could have been Luke Wilson.
I think his nickname is Tim.
It could have been.
Could have been Owen Wilson.
Yeah, it could have been. I don't know.
He is a very attractive young man.
Woodrow Wilson.
I would like to add that.
That's Woodrow.
I wouldn't know him if he came into the studio and said,
what?
I'm Tim Wilson.
What if he was wearing his jersey when he did that?
No, I feel so sorry for those CSN guys who are trying to do like that. Post game commentary, and there's these fans behind
them. Look at these behind
you. Oh my God.
The red.
With the hands between arms.
Oh my God.
Just checking their phones to see if they made the feed.
Oh my God. That is a joke.
They ought to put some sort of a wall up behind those guys.
Yeah. Sell some advertising. Put up a banner.
Did you watch the game last night?
I did. I watched the much of the first period up at Chad's.
Right.
And then
soon to be renamed, we hope.
Got home and was by myself for overtime. Obviously, nervously watching.
So you weren't weeding in the garden at that point?
No.
Because there was a big bright moon last night. You could have weeded
I could have. But I did. I did visit a nursery yesterday, and I picked up some ground covers. I got some creeping phlox for the front yard.
The
for
purples?
The planters.
The purple ones? Yeah, they're very, very nice. It's a great job out of you. Okay.
Sounds like a Potter villain or something.
We'll take
Creeping Flocks.
Yeah, it's a good name. It's better than Chad's.
Hey, what about
Creeping
that?
Flocks.
That's a good band name.
Creeping Flocks.
I think you ought to name
the
restaurant.
I think that's the name of the arena football team, isn't it?
Mitzi's.
The Washington Creeping Flocks?
Mitzi's. Doesn't that happen? Mitzi's.
What says Young more than Mitzi's?
It sounds like a place visitation girls would go to.
Esther's, maybe?
Yeah, okay. Ann Hornaday, when we return, I'm Tony Kornheiser.
This is the Tony Kornheiser Show.
So here's the MeUndies ad, and I had a crisis yesterday on the PTI show.
Uh-oh.
The beginning of the PTI show, Rideholm and Kelleher write the beginnings of the shows, and we pick the ones that are funniest. And this one was that Kevin Love was coming out with a new line of underwear, and Pablo says to me, would you be interested in wearing that? And I said, I'm wearing them right now, game worn, not washed. And he said something about underwear, and I said, on the podcast, I do sell underwear. And I declined to say I sold MeUndies because I felt that, you know, that
this
was over
air?
The
yes.
line. This
yeah.
was on air.
Yes.
I just felt I'm supposed to do it on the podcast, but not on PTI, and it felt
I think that's
like
a proper
cheap,
decision.
Yeah, cheap grab by me, but I was tempted. You know how the wheels of your head are moving.
Yeah, you want to hook them. They mess up. So.
All right. elevate your underwear game to the next level with MeUndies. You've perfected your wardrobe, but what about the stuff not everybody gets to see? If you've been settling for store-bought underwear 5-packs, I have something that will change your life for the better. MeUndies. What is the first thing you put on? The last thing you take off? It's your underwear. Make your most important piece of clothing the best it can be with MeUndies. So, like even Pablo said to me after the thing, you actually do, and I didn't say it on the air. I didn't say it's MeUndies. I said, yeah, I sell underpants. That's pretty much what I do. MeUndies are designed in L.A. and made from sustainably sourced micromodal, a fabric 3 times softer than cotton. MeUndies softer than soft luxe undies come in an ever-changing selection of classic colors, bold shades, and adventurous patterns so you can tailor your undies to your own personal style. And guess what? You can save time and money each month with a monthly subscription. And both Pablo and I, when I got to that part, I said that the thing that intrigued me was the monthly subscription. And he said, yeah, I didn't know that underwear was supposed to wear out all that quickly, that you had to replace it monthly, but maybe you do.
If you buy a pair a month.
Yeah. If you're not ready for a subscription, that's okay. You can still save. That's because MeUndies is offering you 20% off your first pair. Just use our special URL, MeUndies.com/TonyK. Get 20% off your first pair. Go ahead, revamp your underwear drawer. You deserve it. Once again, that is MeUndies.com/TonyK. And it's not really once again because I have to repeat it. It's twice again. MeUndies.com/TonyK.
This is the Tony Kornheiser Show.
Tony Kornheiser Show.
This is Will Salisbury of St. Louis. We've played his music before. The name of his band is Money for Guns. And the name of this tune is Beauty in the Wreckage. That's right. I like the singer. I like the voice.
Some Tom Petty aspect.
Well, he sent a note and said the Columbia Tribune raved
too many words.
That it's a great Tom Petty riff that he ruined with too many words.
I don't know. Sounds good to me.
Yeah, I would agree.
He's playing in Ann Hornaday. We're happy to have Ann. She has 4 movies, I believe, we can talk about. And the first one, the title is The Fate of the Furious. This is chapter 8001 in the Fast and Furious series that goes on even after the death of one of the stars. And every time you see a show on television now, often on ESPN, they have one of the stars of the Something and the Furious
and they ask, what is the movie about? And the answer is always, it's just great. You're going to have to see it for yourself because it's the same movie. And you know what? It's a very good movie. You can, you know, you can look at the second Fast and Furious and go away for a while, and the fifth might be on when you come back, and you think, well, it's pretty good. And am I wrong on this, Ann? They're all the same movies, right? And they're pretty good.
It's the same movie, and you're right. It is. It's good, and this one is very much in that wheelhouse. It's the same gang. I mean, a lot of the appeal of this is the chemistry between all of this wonderful ensemble that they have with Dwayne Johnson and Vin Diesel and Michelle Rodriguez, and now we have Jason Statham shows up. We have Charlize Theron being like, can I say badass on your show?
Yes, I believe you can.
Yep. Yeah. Right. We'll just edit it out later.
Yeah.
And there are a couple of wonderful set pieces. There's one in particular that just really just was so beautifully choreographed, just the action of it. And I don't want to spoil it, but it has to do with cars in New York, and I'll just leave it there. But, yeah, so, you know, it gets the job done. It's not very deep, but it's wildly entertaining. My only quibble is that it was really long. It was like 2 hours plus, which for this kind of thing, you don't need 2 hours plus to do your job.
Well, it's
you know?
Very possible.
Get in, get out, nobody gets hurt. That's
it's very
motto.
Possible they just sort of changed scripts in the middle and just added a couple of scenes because nobody knew what was going on. Like when I'm not
doesn't
knocking.
Doesn't make any sense whatsoever. There's don't look for logic. Don't look for rationality. Don't do that. You're just going to hurt yourself.
Here's what happens, and you know I don't know how in the next three they get any better than this. In one of them, I think, I don't know which one it was, but in one of them, I think they were in outer space and then drove their car out of the spaceship and it landed on 495.
Pretty
and
they, much.
Yeah, I don't
that
know.
That was four.
Yeah.
How do they?
Yeah.
At some point, you just say, really? Can
you
they do that?
Andy, I know. And the last one, of course, they had to cope with the untimely death of Paul Walker. And, right. and for that one, you know, I really got emotional. I mean, I thought they did a really wonderful job with that and saying goodbye to him. It was just very moving, and I thought very well done and tasteful. And he's still, you know, he's still a spirit hovering over this one, which is really nice. But, yeah, I know what you mean. It's like after a certain – it kind of reminded me – there's another really good action movie that came out earlier this year called – it was a sequel to John Wick.
Yeah.
The Keanu Reeves, which also had just some – brilliant action choreography. But you just wonder, you know, after the initial dazzlement. But then again, you know, I was wondering how they would top themselves after the last one, and then they did it with this scene I'm talking about. So
they do
it
all
takes imagination
time.
And chops. And
The Rock, is in all these movies, right? Everybody
and
likes him.
Just so
Everybody
appealing.
Likes him.
Yeah.
Well, adding Jason Statham to me is the key. That's fine.
He's
I'll
good.
Go just to see him. I love him.
So
they're wonderful, and it's those two
the next one
actors
will be out
are the
July.
Ones that have the have a lot of scenes together, and they're really funny together.
If I'm not mistaken, Meryl Streep is in this as well, right?
She's
small. You know, you gave the game away, Nige. But you know, very deep. A lot of layers, a lot of onion skin there to peel back.
Okay, let's go to the next movie. I don't know anything about it. Other than it's written down. The name of the movie is Colossal, and it has Anne Hathaway and Jason Sudeikis. I think I'm in the minority here because I always hear people say terrible things about Anne Hathaway.
Yeah.
I think she's terrific.
Me too.
She's terrific. So
of course she is. Yeah. She's a very talented young lady, and I don't know where that's become almost cliche. That whole thing. You know, it's corny, but no. And this is a really interesting. It's a little indie. You know, it's a little something that just kind of came out of nowhere, and I thought it really worked. It starts out as a Godzilla movie. It's this tradition called Kaiju, which is the Godzilla Mothra stomping on Tokyo genre of monster movies.
Yes.
And they reenact one of those scenes in Seoul, Korea, and with a monster attacking Seoul, and then jump cut to 25 years later, and it's Anne Hathaway in New York playing kind of a party girl who's partying too much and not working enough and doesn't have enough direction in her life, and her boyfriend kicks her out, and she has to kind of go back to New Jersey to reassess. And she goes back to her childhood home where she reacquaints herself with a childhood friend played by Jason Sudeikis. And how that first, you know,
how does
monster
that,
sequence...
Yeah, what is that? How do you get to there?
The Anne Hathaway storyline. I don't want to give anything away, but it's very ingeniously braided together. And it keeps getting more interesting in terms of what you think this movie's about, because at first you think, oh, it's about her character, you know, getting sober and growing up and, you know, getting right and straightening up. And it's a little bit about that, but it really isn't about that. It's much more complex. And I thought, really, you just never know where this movie is going. She's terrific. Sudeikis is really good, and his character, in terms of the changes his character goes through, he's perfectly cast as this guy. And I just thought it was really original. And the way that the filmmaker mashed up these two kind of genres and used that monster genre to look at some, you know, some pretty, I don't want to oversell this, you know, I mean, but just the way that he uses that vernacular to explore identity and power. And I thought it was very nicely done and really, like I said, very original, very novel.
Colossal, it's called.
Colossal.
I guess that's because of the monster parts. Okay. There is something called Their Finest. It is described to me as people falling in love while filming something about Dunkirk. Are they filming it? Is it in World War II? Are they filming it now, looking back on Dunkirk?
No, it's not a It's not the EPK for the Chris Nolan film coming out. No.
Okay.
This takes place. It's a World War II era story. It's based on a novel, which I had not heard of, called Their Finest Hour and a Half. And it's about the people who were recruited into the war effort in the propaganda office, creating propaganda films to kind of boost morale for the British citizenry. And it's centered around a young woman who's a copywriter who kind of gets roped into writing the women's dialogue for these movies, because they really want to appeal to the women of Britain. And it's just this kind of wacky, sweet-natured, funny, romantic, but also really affecting. I mean, they don't shy away. It takes place during the Blitz, and so we do see bombings, and we see the aftermath of bombings, and some people don't make it, and people that you don't expect not to make it don't make it. And so you're kind of laughing along, and it's very sweet and good-hearted, and then boom, you know, somebody's gone that you've really learned to, you know, grown to care about. And I just think it's calibrated so well. It's got a great kind of classical movie look to it. Bill Nighy plays the corny, you know, the ham actor in this little propaganda film about Dunkirk that they're making. He's hilarious, as he always is. Gemma Arterton plays the young woman. Sam Claflin is one of her romantic interests. Jack Huston. It's got a great cast. Lovely little movie. Just, you know, a lot of fun to watch. Very entertaining. We hadn't talked in the last couple of weeks, but there have been, you know, we didn't talk about Queen of the Desert, the Gertrude Bell movie. But, you know, historical dramas can get starchy real fast, and this one is sprightly and it's fast, it's swift, it's funny, smart. I really fell for it. It's by the same director who did An Education, which, you know, remember,
I liked that movie.
I
liked it, although I thought it was actually the most anti-Semitic movie I think I'd ever seen.
Oh, very interesting.
Yeah, I really did. But I thought it was a very well-done movie, and Carrie Mulligan.
You know the style. So she, so Lone Scherfig, you know, she really knows about period, how to keep a period movie from getting too kitschy, and also just calibrating all those emotions, you know, because An Education was like that too. You know, it had some humor in it.
Yes.
It had a lot of pathos. You know what I mean? It had a lot of, you know, different emotional tones.
I tend to like period pieces. They don't have to go that far back in history for me. They really don't. But I really
think you'd like this movie. Yeah. I mean, I think
it's like, remember I told you, I thought Brooklyn was the best movie I saw that whole
year.
And
funny you should mention it, because it's the exact same producers.
Well,
and it reminded me of Brooklyn too. And it's the same production team that did Brooklyn and Carol. So you're talking about people who really have a lot of taste, and they're not going to put out schlock. I think you'd like this one.
Thanks for mentioning schlock, because it leads us to the next movie, which is Going in Style, that I'm told you can talk about.
Oh, yeah.
Now, this is a movie which has Alan Arkin, who has won an Academy Award.
Yes.
Michael Caine, who has won an Academy Award. And Morgan Freeman, who has won an Academy Award.
Yes.
If you look at this, it's a remake of a George Burns movie from not that long ago, 30 years ago, something like that.
Yeah, not long to you and me, my friend. But
so when I look at the trailer, the stuff that they put on TV, I actually think to myself, this might be the worst movie ever made.
No.
No?
It's not. No.
Okay.
No.
Tell
I mean,
me.
Oh, look, I want to be careful. I want to manage expectations. I am not making a case for this as a masterpiece by any stretch, but I also cannot lie. I sat there and I chuckled and I laughed and I enjoyed it, as did the people in the audience I saw it with. It's that kind of low simmer, low key, like, hey, this is actually kind of a nice little movie, and especially those guys. It's like they
really?
Are so good together.
Really?
They're wonderful. They're wonderful, wonderful, wonderful. Yes, it has the corny, schlocky, you know, the sight gags, and they have to have a grandma dropping the F-bomb, which I never want to see again because it's right. just not funny anymore. So, yes, it has it has some creaky bits.
It doesn't feel like a money grab to you?
No.
Just like, let's work for 3 weeks?
It didn't for me, no. And it's okay. Especially because these guys never, ever, ever, ever beg for the laugh. And I think, like, you know, Michael Caine wrote one of the best books ever about acting. And in it, he talked about comic acting. And basically, it's that you don't play the comedy. You know, you always play it straight. And they all know how to do that, and they do that, and it's quite wonderful, and the chemistry between them is quite wonderful. And Arkin is absolutely flat out. He's the grump, you know, he's the Eeyore and the grouch, and he's just hysterical. So, you know, like I said, I'm not going to tell you that it's, you know, it's gonna cure cancer or anything like that, but I think for what it sets out to do, it does it really well, and they are really special.
So we were talking about this yesterday at the PTI show. This movie and this type of movie, and I mentioned that I had seen Last Vegas a couple of years ago and thought it was okay. And and the consensus among people there, and most of these people are in their 20s and 30s, they're not old. They go, wow, these movies must make a lot of money, because you see these kinds of movies with big name people all the time.
Robert
now.
De Niro has movies
all
like this.
All the time.
Yeah.
Well, they do, and this one, I think, I don't have the stats in front of me, but I think this one, quote-unquote, overperformed last weekend when it opened, because there is, look, when you think about who is still going to movies, it's old poops like me and you and our parents, and you know, they have that movie-going habit where they do want to go to they still want to go to the theater and see, they want to get out of the house, you know, like teenagers, and they need things to go see, you know, and when they get it, they'll go see it. I mean, you know, but now, mind you, they may not go opening weekend necessarily because they also have other obligations in their lives.
Too
so these are the kinds of movies that need to stick around and build an audience and get some word of mouth. Like I will tell my father to go see this movie, and then he'll tell his Friday Romeo group, the you know, retired old men eating out. Everybody has one. Every city has one.
Yeah.
It's a market, and it deserves to be catered to, and it deserves to be catered to without condescension. And you mentioned Las Vegas. If you thought Las Vegas was okay, I think you'd really like this one.
I did. I was perfectly happy with it.
But it's in that same... This one's even better. I thought this was even better.
I'm very surprised. I am. I'm very surprised.
Just the entertainment value in terms of just sitting there and thinking, like, you know what? This is actually really sweet, and I'm enjoying it. And I laughed, you know, as they say.
Las Vegas, by the way, budget of $28 million, box office of $134 million.
There you go. Wow.
And this movie did $12 million last week on a budget of 25, so
there you,
halfway
it,
home.
It's going to do just great. Yeah, okay. It's going to do well. And this keeps happening. And you mentioned De Niro. I don't know what, and Anna Hathaway. They had a wonderful movie together, The Intern.
That was much better than I thought it was going to be.
There you go. See,
it was much better.
That's where I'm going with this. It's like, they may not be described as great movies in the canon, but they're good and they're fine and they kind of simmer along nicely, and you don't feel ripped off or hard done by, you know.
Well, that's a pleasant surprise.
You feel like
for
you've
me.
Gotten your entertainment value.
Okay. Thank you, Anne. Talk to you.
Thank you very much.
Anne Hornaday, boys and girls, we will take a break. We will come back with news. Nigel will do the news. I'm Tony Kornheiser.
You're listening to The Tony Kornheiser Show.
Casper is a sleep brand that created one perfect mattress sold directly to consumers, eliminating commission-driven inflated prices. Its award-winning sleep surface was developed in-house. It has a sleek design, and it is delivered in a small, sized box. In addition to the mattress, Casper also offers an adaptive pillow and soft, breathable sheets. The mattress industry has forced consumers into paying notoriously high markups. Casper is revolutionizing the mattress industry by cutting the cost of dealing with resellers in showrooms and passing that savings directly to the consumer. Buying a Casper mattress is completely risk-free. Casper offers free delivery and free returns with a 100-night home trial. If you don't love it, they will pick it up and refund you everything. Casper understands the importance of truly sleeping on a mattress before you commit, especially considering you're going to spend a third of your life on it. Casper is an obsessively engineered mattress at a shockingly fair price. It combines supportive memory foams to create an award-winning sleep service with just the right sink and just the right bounce. With over 20,000 reviews and an average of 4.8 stars, it's quickly becoming the internet's favorite mattress. There's free shipping and returns in the United States and Canada. And if you try Casper for 100 nights risk-free in your own home, and then you don't love it, they will pick it up and refund you everything. It is designed, developed, and assembled in the United States of America, and you can get $50 towards any mattress purchase by visiting www.casper.com/Tony. And Casper is spelled C-A-S-P-E-R. Use the promo code Tony. Let's do it again. www.casper.com/Tony. Terms and conditions apply.
You're listening to The Tony Kornheiser Show.
This is sent to us by Davis Vardaman, the son of the great Jack Vardaman, one of the sons of the great Jack Vardaman. This is a song called So You Think You Can Dance, written and sung by Claire Vardaman, a newly minted little and the woman to whom Davis is happily related by marriage. The name of his band is Old Fuss and Feathers from Denver, Colorado.
It's also a good name for a restaurant.
A lot of things are good names.
People who doesn't like feathers
only
in their food?
Is a bad name.
Everyone likes
for
feathers
restaurant.
In their food.
So I love the great Jack Vardaman, who I will see next week.
It's beautiful.
Yes,
it's
lovely.
It's lovely.
We have news, and Nigel has news.
Yes, indeed, Mr. Tony. And I know there was a lot of excitement in the world of sports last night, and I know your TV was directed towards the WNBA draft. You wanted to see who the Mystics grabbed with the sixth pick overall.
The reason I want this brought up today is because while we were sitting here yesterday, there seemed to be a consensus that the Mystics had no first-round pick.
I believe the news staff got that wrong.
Yes. Because imagine my surprise found out they did have a first-round pick.
And if that's the case, I mean, that they only slid down five spots and they still got Elena Delladon, I mean, that's a brilliant trade for them.
Yes.
And so now they wind up with somebody from Maryland, a woman by the name of Shatori Walker-Kimbrough.
Yeah, it's great.
So
is it Kimbrough Walker?
No, that's Kemba Walker.
Kemba Walker is from
Connecticut.
Yes. So, and that's about as extensive as I can get in my analysis.
Well, how do we think it's
I can break it down for you. Yeah. I've seen her play a little bit because we go to some Maryland. Of those games with the kids, and she's a great player. But, you know, these drafts are a player and a half deep. And then you just take someone local and hope to sell some tickets. Isn't that basically how it works
in the WNBA? It doesn't matter what they did in
the
draft.
She's a fine player.
They have Elena Delladon.
Yes.
That's all they need. She's the best player in the world.
Yes.
So that's all they need.
Yes. And I will say this. Our mock drafts were correct in that Kelsey Plum went number one. So we all had that.
Yes, yeah. we all had that.
Yeah.
Yes.
Something's going on in Memphis, Mr. Tony.
Yes, something is.
Lots of players are transferring from the Memphis basketball team. In fact, let's see. They've lost
six.
Three top scorers from last season. It's six of their top eight scorers from
six.
Last season's team.
Six people.
Yes. And the latest, I guess, KJ Lawson, who announced his transfer this week.
The two Lawson brothers started on the team. Their father, Keelon Lawson, was an assistant coach at Memphis under Josh Pastner.
Right.
Josh Pastner left to go to Georgia Tech. Keelon stayed there. Tubby Smith came in. Tubby Smith has won a national championship at Kentucky. He has taken five different schools to the NCAAs without a breath of scandal, wherever he's gone.
Right.
So Tubby Smith...
Semi-local, right? Eastern Shore guy, I believe.
Tubby Smith, to me, gets the benefit of the doubt. Tubby Smith demoted Keelon... Lawson? Demoted him. Mm-hmm. Not this year, but the previous year. His two kids then left this year. The two more kids, it's like the, you know, LeVar Ball family situation. He's got two top 100 players in school. They started. They've now left. They've gone to Kansas. You don't think Kansas? Kansas is one of the top five schools in the country, and they're welcoming these kids. He has two more sons who would have gone to Memphis had he been an assistant coach of consequence, and he's got a nephew. These are the best players in all of Memphis. if you're Tubby Smith, you're the AD of that school, and you're backing your coach. The AD has backed Tubby Smith.
Yes.
And I don't know anything about Keylon. I mean, I really don't. But if you've closed off the pipeline of the best players in the city that your university represents, one of the reasons it is said constantly that John Thompson III is no longer coaching at Georgetown was because he didn't recruit D.C. well. Memphis is a very rich basketball city. So
Keylon was hired, I believe, prior to the kids coming to Memphis as an inducement to bring the kids.
Yes, and I have not. I don't see anything wrong with that.
But, right. He was an accomplished coach.
That's right.
Yeah.
Well, was he?
Yeah, he was.
Or was he just...
Well, he had been a coach.
Did they just plant his flag there to get the sons there?
I would do that, too. Why wouldn't I do that?
This is like when Delonte Hill was hired to go to Kansas State under Bob Huggins, and Michael Beasley followed him, except Delonte Hill was getting like $400,000, some unheard amount of money for a guy with no experience. This guy at least was an experienced
coach.
Well,
unless you're Tubby Smith and this guy is undercutting you and stabbing you in the back.
And that's what we don't know.
Right.
What we don't know is anything about the relationship between Keylon and Tubby. We don't know that. But I'm pretty safe in saying this, that if you can't recruit the best players in your city and you represent that city, you are in trouble already.
Yes.
In trouble already. Mm-hmm. So I don't know how that works.
Tubby, to your point, squeaky clean image.
Yes.
And is it five teams to the tournament?
He's really good.
He's really good.
He's really good. But
so is Dedrick Lawson.
You know.
And the sort of negative twist to all this is that KJ Lawson, somebody put a video camera in front of him.
Yeah, that wasn't great.
And he just cursed. Said, blank Tubby.
Yeah.
He issued a very deep apology.
That was his apology. It was not on the level of Oscar.
Well, if he said blank, it could be any. He could have said love Tubby.
Not on the level of Oscar Morenz. Is that it? What is Oscar's name?
Munoz. I think it's Oscar Gamble, actually.
Oscar Gamble.
Yes.
Okay.
This is going to be tough for you, Mr. Tony. I know you had plans to go to an amusement park this weekend, to especially go to the roller coaster.
Michael, as a child, how many roller coaster rides did you take with your dad?
Zero.
That's true.
Right. That would be zero.
You've never been on one. You've probably never been on one, have you? Well,
yes. Been on one.
Been on one, that's it. Right.
That was enough.
As an adult male?
No.
Or as a kid?
As a child?
Oh, you just know. Okay, no. I'm not doing
that. I think you went on the log ride with us once.
Hated it. Scared to death. I love the log ride.
Well, I've actually ridden the Joker's Jinx, the very roller coaster in question.
Yes, this is at Six Flags.
Did you feel deprived? Because you were allowed to go on roller coasters.
He's feeling it now.
You know, I had to go on a few roller coasters with Mom, but I hate roller coasters now.
Your sister likes them, and your mother likes them.
Yeah.
I don't.
You prefer them. You prefer a pony, right?
Yeah, I do like a nice adult pony ride.
Jeannie, you like
them? You'll do it all?
I love roller coasters.
Helix, corkscrew.
I hate loop. Ferris wheels. I could go on roller coasters all day long. And if I got stuck on a roller coaster, I think I could deal. If I got stuck on a Ferris wheel, I'd be one hurting person.
You know, when you're stuck on the top of a Ferris wheel at Palisades Park.
Freddie Boom Boom Cannon.
But written by Chuck Barris.
Yes. So wait.
Are you okay if you're sitting in the roller coaster versus when you have to strap in with the vest?
What if you're upside down?
I'm fine.
You're hanging upside down like a bat.
Rush of blood to the head.
That's problematic.
I wouldn't like that.
Can you explain the story?
So, yes, the Six Flags America in Maryland, I guess yesterday.
Are those still owned by Dan Snyder?
I believe they are.
I can check that for you.
I believe they are. Joker's Jinx ride stalled with 24 riders on board.
That's not a bad name for a restaurant, Joker's Jinx.
Joker's Jinx, that sounds good. What about Six Flags? Can you take that?
I don't want that.
Mitzi's Jinx.
Somebody else.
Again, going for that young crowd, Mitzi's, where we feature naps and soup all day long. So the Joker's Jinx stalled with 24 riders on board, and as the Six Flags spokeswoman said, it did not complete its regular ride cycle, causing it to stop at a safe location on the track.
Yes, and it had to be re-architectured.
They have to re-accommodate all those passengers.
Yeah, re-accommodate them, yes. Yeah. So they were about 75 feet off the ground.
At least they were sitting.
Yes.
And they were not hanging upside down.
They weren't upside down, which, as the firefighter said, meant that we didn't really have to hurry. Now, I'm thinking if I'm up there, I'm like, get me off of this thing immediately.
Are you a roller coaster person? Do you like them?
No, I've been on one, and I really didn't enjoy it at all.
Yeah,
I'm not sure. Yeah, there's not much at an amusement park that I really enjoy.
No.
Not even a funnel cake for me.
No, I don't like it.
Yeah. So by about 8:15, they'd rescued 10 people, and they were all okay, as the firefighter said. And then they got the rest down about an hour later. The youngest, there were a few kids. Youngest were 9 and 10. Nobody was injured. None of the riders were in any type of distress. So
in that story, does it talk about this happening before and payouts?
Yes, it does.
This was the most interesting thing to me.
2014, 25 riders, including 7 children, were stuck in the stall ride for as long as 5 hours. A judge later ordered the park to award one family $60,000 in the incident, $10,000 for each family member stuck
on the
ride.
We're talking United airplane money.
That's incentive to take your kid to the park.
Right. Yeah.
Hope you get lucky.
Right. Go again. Yeah. Now, the Six Flags, now this is how they describe the Joker's Jinx, is a hilariously intimidating concoction designed by the world's most notorious supervillain. You will simply be pulsed into the middle of the excitement pretty much instantly, so try to brace yourself.
Well, here's the thing about Joker's Jinx, and I have ridden it. It's one of those roller coasters that's like 0 to 50 like that. I mean, it juts you off, and then it does like... When we were kids, you'd have a roller... I mean, I remember like the Rebel Yell at King's Dominion. It would go up and down, or maybe it's got a loop, but now they do like the DNA helix, like the sideways twisting.
You know a lot about roller coasters. All that.
Well, I got 3 kids that love amusement parks, so...
Do you like roller coasters?
Decreasingly.
How about Kim? Does Kim like them?
Yeah, Kim loves them, but they get sort of crazier and crazier. I'm not really prone to motion sickness, but they push the limits now, you know.
You want to describe all the ones you've been on?
Well, I started with the Glen Echo roller coaster, which
was made
of wood.
Wood, rickety wood.
Which rattled like a mousetrap as you went along it. So that was encoded early. And everything else seemed like ultra modern and sleek compared to that.
And you have, not only do you have no fears, you enjoy these.
I do.
Okay. So I will now, I'm going to talk about taking, I think, Michael. Or I don't know if it was Michael or Elizabeth, to Universal in Orlando.
Yes.
And he's laughing already.
And he says laughingly.
He can't contain himself.
And I was talked into going on a ride.
I think it was the Star Wars ride.
It's not even a ride.
The teacups?
You just sit in your seat. Uh-huh.
It's like one of those 4D experiences.
You're actually in your seat. Right. You're in a theater, a darkened theater. And while you are moving, you're not going upside down. There's no speed.
You're sort of pivoting, and it's all sort of.
I was terrified. I broke out into unbelievable flop sweat. I closed my eyes for the whole thing, just begging that this thing would stop. I just could not stand it.
Yes, pivoting is the right term to describe the motion of this particular activity, not even a ride.
That's
Universal. You haven't, with the ESPN connection, never done the Disney.
I've been to Disney, but we went to Universal for one day or something like that, because they're both in Orlando.
Right.
And I had no idea. It was Star Wars. I had no idea what I figured I'm in my seat.
Can't be where that am bad.
My God, I just could not. I couldn't take it.
What's the Disney one that's the roller coaster in the dark? Is that Magic?
Space Mountain.
I went on that with the kids.
But it was not a roller coaster. It didn't seem to be a...
It is. It's just in the pitch black.
Does it go through a mountain or something
for
like
some
that?
For some reason, yeah. I went on that, eyes closed the whole time.
That's just a single, like terrified. A single person per car. It's
there's,
like a capsule.
There's a
single
the log
capsule.
Flume ride, which everybody loves.
That was the scariest.
I love that.
Everybody loves the log flume ride.
You did not.
The log flume ride, my eyes are closed for the entire thing, except... When
you're not good with the water.
When there's a descent
you can see land at least
700 feet in less than a second, and then they take a picture of you, my eyes are wide open in terror.
Yes.
Terror.
Smiling face or no?
Yeah. Oh,
that's,
man.
That's the one thing I do remember. Is you get off the ride, they have a photo, and you're like, well, I look horrified.
Right.
Right.
Yeah. And you're soaking wet.
So have you been on the one where they just raise you up and up and up, and they click, 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 and then it's just like a dead drop?
No.
I don't
want to do that. Have you been on?
I've not done the outside ones. I know what you're talking about. I did the Tower of Terror.
Yeah, that's in Disney. Yeah.
That's what Nice is talking about. That just goes up and down.
Right, but that's, you're in an elevator versus the outdoor one where you're just strapped in looking at the entire park.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Do you want to do that?
No, I want to never go back to an amusement park in my life.
Right, that's how I felt. I remember taking them to Hershey Park. And just, I couldn't.
I thought you guys did a Disney honeymoon. That wasn't you?
Oh, we do. We go back to Disney every year.
Right.
No, we went to Disney and played golf. Played a lot of golf.
It's a small world.
But we in Hershey Park was the capital of tattoos in America. It was a Memorial Day weekend
Fats
at Hershey
and
Park, and it was just wow. It's not for me. It's just not for me, and it's
you like
smelly.
You like a small train that just goes in a very small, very slowly.
Like Cabin John Park.
That's all.
The Cabin John Park. Train.
I don't really want to. I like. You know what I like? I like a golf cart.
Yeah, golf cart.
Get
nice.
On a golf cart.
Those are fun.
Now, would you go on the pirate ship at out in Rehoboth? The pirate
that
ship
rocks?
That just goes.
Oh,
rocks
oh no
back
no
and
no!
Forth.
I've been on. I was.
Good Lord, no.
I was on one of those briefly and said, I've got to get off
bumper
this
cars.
Thing.
Bumper
that
cars?
That was in Disney. I did that in Disney.
Yeah.
The Viking ship or something
yeah,
like that.
Yeah, that's too much like a Ferris wheel.
Like it's
me.
Like a pendulum.
What,
yeah.
What is your... If you're willing to go upside down and sideways at 75 miles an hour, what is your problem with a Ferris wheel?
Slow
because
circles.
I'm always on it with somebody who thinks it's fun to rock the car.
Oh, okay.
As you're going around. So it's that same rocking motion as the pirate ship that makes me want to hurl.
Just, it's not for me. Not for me. Yeah. All right. Can we get out of here now?
I do have one more story if you'd like. Oh, do we have time?
Sure.
Daniel Gomez Flores is a soccer player who is a United States citizen, but he's playing for a club in Tijuana. And so he lives in Tijuana. But as he said, I decided to go across the border to get breakfast at Denny's and then just come back because we've got a match.
I certainly understand that.
Right. So he came back at about 5 a.m. and the Border Patrol stopped him. They flagged his Sebring and they looked at it and they said, there's something wrong with this spare tire.
Uh-oh.
Yes. They said they found it was not of a normal weight and when pressed had hard spots. So they cut it open and they found 23 packages bound with clear plastic wrap, carbon paper, each which was filled with a clear crystal-like substance that indeed tested positive as methamphetamine.
Yeah.
When they finally ripped the entire car apart, they found 48 pounds.
Hmm.
48 pounds of crystal meth.
That soccer career is not going anywhere.
Well, and Flores said...
It's not my car.
Of course not.
Well, it's not my car.
It's my cousin's.
It's not mine.
I know nothing of how these drugs got there.
Yeah.
But here's what probably happened. I traded this vehicle with another guy about 3 months
just
ago.
Just a guy.
For his car. But then I had some mechanical problems.
That.
So I swapped back. And that was probably when he put
he
this
did it.
48
yeah.
pounds
he
of...
He did it.
Word to the wise. The 5 a.m. border crossing is probably ill-advised.
Yeah, so good there job. You go. Good job. Right. All right. We will come back. We'll do Old Guy Radio when we return. I am Tony Kornheiser.
This is the Tony Kornheiser Show.
Here's the Blue Apron read. Not all ingredients are created equal. Fresh, high-quality ingredients make a real difference, so it's important to know where your food comes from. Didn't Tori say yesterday she's back on the Blue Apron line?
Yes, she did.
Yeah, and she was happy to be back on the Blue Apron
line. Very much
so. So people on this show can get on the line, and they're happy to do it. Blue Apron, which I liked very much, is affordable. For less than $10 per person per meal, Blue Apron delivers seasonal recipes along with pre-portioned ingredients to make delicious home-cooked meals. There's a variety of new recipes every week, or you can let Blue Apron's culinary team surprise you. Recipes are not repeated within a year. You'll never get bored. There's flexibility. You can customize your recipes each week based on your preferences. Blue Apron has several delivery options, so you can choose what fits your needs. And there's no weekly commitment. You only get deliveries when you want them, which is what Tori Clark is doing. It's easy. Each meal comes with a step-by-step, easy-to-follow recipe card and pre-portioned ingredients and can be prepared in 40 minutes or less. Give yourself time because you got to go step by step and it's not making a hamburger. It's different. It's different. It takes your attention. And there's a guarantee. Blue Apron's freshness guarantee promises that every ingredient in your delivery arrives ready to cook or they will make it right. As ever, you can check out this week's menu. You can get your first three meals free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/TonyK. You'll love how good it feels and tastes to create incredible home-cooked meals with Blue Apron. So don't wait. That is Blue Apron. .com/TonyK. Blue Apron, a better way to cook.
You're listening to the Tony Kornheiser Show.
Old Guy Radio for the day is the classic Be My Baby. That's Ronnie Spector. She and Phil Spector, a couple of lovely kids, were married 49 years ago today. You have some news about, well, we know what happened to Phil.
Yeah, we
Phil's
do.
Phil's not coming out.
Yes. First of all, Ronnie Spector is the only Ronette who actually sings on this song.
Well, she's the best.
Yes.
Yes. But you know who some of the people who were, it was a massive crew because the World of Sound, that, and this was one of the first World of Sound songs that Spector did, but here's some of the people that were in the studio helping out. Sonny and Cher on backing vocals. Darling Love backing vocals. I guess that's Leon Russell on keyboards. But Sonny and Cher, I had no idea that they were part of this.
Salvatore Bono.
And apparently,
Cheryl Sarkeesian.
This had a massive effect on Brian Wilson.
When
he heard it, he says, I was in my car with my girlfriend. We were driving around when all of a sudden, Wink Martindale, whom we remember also as a game show host. Yeah.
That's right.
He says, all right, here you go with Be My Baby. And it started playing. All of a sudden, I get to this part of Be My Baby, Be My Baby. And I said, what is going on? I pulled over to the side of the curb and just said, my God, wait a minute. His mind absolutely blown. And his daughter later said that every morning when we woke up to that song. He just played it endlessly.
Who doesn't love that song, no matter who sings it?
It's definitely in my top ten. It might be in my top five.
It's a great, great song.
Yes.
Sung perfectly, produced perfectly. That marriage ended.
Yes, it did.
Not perfectly.
He kept her in a closet for a while, I think.
Not good. All right. So I've got a lot of, I don't really have a lot. I've got a bunch of things I wrote down.
All right. Well, mailbag's next.
No.
Oh, you got something then.
Well, I wanted to talk to Michael. Is there anything in particular? You're going to go to the Nats tonight, right?
This afternoon.
That's your birthday present?
Birthday present.
Is it a 4 o'clock game or
it's
an early
game? It's 4:05. We have Strasburg pitching. I think it's going to be about 66 degrees at game time. So.
I sense perfect. Tightness.
Yeah. Lat strain.
So thank you for mentioning Strasburg. Strasburg was the subject of a PTI story yesterday. Strasburg, there's a Wall Street Journal story about Strasburg, Yu Darvish, and Noah Syndergaard. Now, these are guys who can get pretty close to 100. Syndergaard goes over 100. Darvish is really, really fast. And obviously, Strasburg is 96, 97, 98, somewhere in there. They have stopped windups. They pitch from the stretch all the time. Mariano Rivera came in and pitched from the stretch all the time, even when he started an inning. These are relief guys. And you just go, it's no big deal. The reason we did the story is because I am old enough, and I don't know if Michael is old enough, but certainly Gary is old enough, Jeannie is old enough, to remember that pitching, the big windup, was this fabulous theatrical thing. Juan Marichal kicked his left leg over his head before he released the ball. Louis Tiant shook the ball down for about 10 seconds and pivoted halfway around. There were all of these, for lack of a better word, theatrical windups. And when I was a kid, of course, I wanted to pitch that way. As a little league pitcher, I tried to get the Juan Marichal windup. There were people who had the double pump before they released the ball.
Yep.
But every pitcher,
rocking arms.
Every pitcher had a windup motion. And I assumed my entire life, I assumed that the reason you did it that way was because that motion added speed and power.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Or else why would you do it?
The little bit I know about physics would suggest that.
Yeah, put a little momentum.
That it would add speed and power. It doesn't. And that's why Strasburg and Syndergaard and Darvish, they don't do it anymore because too many things can go wrong mechanically when you have the big windup.
Not to mention
injury. And I'm sort of stunned, you know, that everything I believed in about why you would have the windup is not true.
Now, besides Strasburg, which of those pitchers has had Tommy John surgery? Have the other two had it?
I don't know.
No,
Darvish was out for a long period of time last year.
I don't think he had Tommy John.
I don't think Syndergaard's had it. Matt Harvey's had it.
Because I was just wondering if somebody looked at the Tommy John patients and said, whoa, let's stop with the windup guys.
Maybe that's the case. But it seems...
Well, if the science supports that it does not add speed, then you would have to think in 20 years the windup will be gone.
So here's what I'm getting to. That baseball, which is the most antiquated and slow game that everybody says, oh, it's too slow. Oh, nobody likes baseball anymore. Baseball, it seems to me, is using science in ways that neither football nor basketball can. They just can't. But what are you going to do in the science of basketball? You run and you jump. It's not the same thing. But in baseball, there are things like the pitching motion that you can study. Maybe you can study the shooting motion, but I don't know how you would change
Think of how much a game is shortened, because I'm sure it's some matter of minutes by neither starting pitcher winding up. They would legislate it out, but I'm saying if 10 years down the road, you got a game with two starting pitchers and neither of them's winding up, it's got to, a windup is easily 4 or 5 seconds a pitch, right?
That seems like a lot. Well, I think it's a second.
Put a stop
or two.
Clock on that.
Yeah, I don't know. But you can look at basketball. The biggest change in basketball is a 3-point shot. Like, that changes the game. It moves the game out. But baseball is considering some managers, the Joe Maddons of the world, they're using 4 outfielders. They're changing it. Defensive shifts are happening all the time. It seems to me there is more innovation in baseball, the allegedly antiquated game, than any other.
Well, there was that one study this year or last year about the two-handed foul shot in basketball, like the sort of alley-oop shot.
The
underhand shot. How much more effective. Yeah, that's
But they don't want to use it.
Right.
Because they think it makes them look uncool.
Look like a girl. Yeah,
so nobody wants to use
it. Yeah,
it's
way cooler to shoot 52%.
It's like in putting, 10, 15 years ago, it was unpopular to use left hand low or to use a claw-style grip, and all of a sudden that is now scientifically for some people better, or the oversized grip.
Yeah, I would say golf rivals.
Yes.
In terms of use of science. I mean, constantly
that's
evolving.
That's true, with the swing.
With the pitching motion.
But that's not a team sport.
I think with those windups, for some, it could just, you might have been thinking about a trigger move that might have gotten your body more relaxed, so you might have felt like you were throwing the ball faster because you were getting to sort of your maximum efficiency a little bit faster, the same way you might have a forward press when you're putting, or a little trigger move if you're at the free throw line, or in any static to quick motion.
And the fluidity of the windup might give the appearance or feel of sort of a less traumatic.
But it's just theater.
Isn't it hard for pitchers and golfers particularly to unlearn something like that if it's sort of part of your whole?
I would think so.
Well, but every pitcher,
they can all pitch
every
from the
starter,
stretch.
Yeah, every starter knows that in order to hold a runner on, you can't go to the big windup because they'll steal on
so
you.
So it's just getting out of the habit of
Syndergaard, they steal on Syndergaard all the time, apparently even from the stretch.
Well, John Lester's another guy that can't keep a, hold
Well, he can't hold a runner on.
Right.
And he's a lefty.
Yes.
And he can't hold a runner on.
Right. Yeah, I think a lot of it is the mechanics of it, and that you simplify it. It's less things to go wrong for you in your delivery of it. So I think that's why they try and simplify.
Interesting story.
So I thought. I do think.
But you're right. I mean, the Marischal. You're right. That's part of baseball's
Warren Spahn
lore.
Too. Huge, the high leg kick.
Yeah, and every little kid playing.
You're hiding
ball.
The ball from.
Yeah.
But in fact, the game begins when you release the ball.
Yes.
That's when the game begins. You can do. You can go out there in a cape. It doesn't matter. Once you release the ball is when it starts. But I do think
the beginning
it'll
of the end for the windup?
I would think.
Yeah.
I would think if you're just as fast and you're less prone to error, so I would think and that's weird. That was weird to me. An interesting story. Pablo, of course, went crazy on that because he can understand the physics of it. So I wanted to tell this story the other day, which I didn't, about when I was down at the Masters. I explained that there are these large dinners that, that everybody has large dinners. And the dinner that we went to on Saturday night, had about 30 people. And one of the things that happened at the dinner was somebody, I guess from TaylorMade, I think it was TaylorMade, was out in the backyard of this particular house, and he was giving away wedges, which often happens. You at golf functions, there's somebody out there fitting you for clubs.
Unlike a sorority party where they'd give out wedgies.
Yes, it would be different. So I did not get a wedge or anything like that because it no longer matters.
You didn't ask for a wedge though. I don't know, 1 degree flat, 35 and a half inches.
Didn't do anything like that.
10 degrees of bounce.
No, but I watched the guy
driver,
in front of me.
You already got your driver.
There was an
D5
older gentleman.
Swing weight.
Right. I've gotten you wedges with your initials on them.
And I said thank you.
Yeah. It's about time.
Now he's done it publicly also.
Yeah.
Anyway, so there's an older gentleman, even older than I, who is talking to the wedge guy as I go out to just say hello to the wedge guy. I play golf and play it poorly. I have no scientific mind. So what you tell me, what all those things that Michael just said, they're totally lost on me. I can't even hit the ball in the sand. When the ball's in the sand, I hit the ball and the ball goes 40 to 50 yards over the green. It's awful. Or I hit so much sand that the ball doesn't get out of the trap. So it's a disaster for me. Even though my son has tried very
quick
hard.
Lesson, you stand up, you get nervous, and you stand up with your right side, whereas I want you to squat down into the sand with your toes pointing out from a wider than normal base and lower the handle for more height. You're going to open up some more bounce.
Have you tried a high leg kick?
Haven't done that yet. Anyway, so this guy is talking to him, and he's saying he likes the wedge very much, and he'd like that wedge. It was a 60-degree wedge, and he was explaining when he used the 60-degree wedge. And so he says, well, where should I send it? And he gives his name and he gives his address and just says Bob Jones. Well, when you're in golf, when you're in a golf situation and somebody says Bob Jones, well, okay, you're paying attention to that. It turns out it's Robert Trent Jones Jr. Robert Trent Jones is considered, and I will bow to Michael on this, but certainly one of the best five golf course designers, American golf course designers, one of the best five, fair to say?
Yeah, that is correct.
Okay. And he designed, the first course that Robert Trent Jones designed was when he was a graduate student at Cornell, a course that is still used by the Cornell golf team, a course that I have played a number of times. He designed in a nearby city in upstate New York, in Hamilton, New York, on the campus of Colgate University, Seven Oaks. Seven Oaks is a course that Michael and I played with Mark Murphy when Mark Murphy had left the Redskins to go back to his alma mater and was the athletic director there. I have since played it as well. RTJ in Virginia is named for his dad, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's his dad's course. Robert Trent Jones Jr. has designed a million courses. And I was awed. Okay, so now he says, the one tip he gives me, he says, look, you keep your hands low. Now, I don't even have to see my son glaring at me now because I know that he would say, I've told you that 100 times. But when Robert Trent Jones Jr. says, why don't you try to keep your grip low? Don't do a regular grip, right? Go down on the shelf.
Yeah, I don't know why you trust an architect over your son. The architect's trying to get you into the bunker.
Well, that's probably true. So we sat together at dinner. We were seated next to each other, and I'm awestruck because it's Robert Trent Jones Jr.
Sure, right.
There are the two great Bobby Jones names are Robert Tyre Jones, the original Bobby Jones, who designed Augusta and who was the greatest golfer in his day and won the Grand Slam when it consisted of amateur tournaments. That's right, great. Amateur tournaments.
He's a great amateur player, right?
Yeah. And one of the all-time greats. And then the other Robert Trent Jones and that family. And we're sitting there, and we got along very well because he said he was from Jersey. I'm just a Jersey boy, and I said, well, I'm from Long Island, and we started talking about the Brooklyn Dodgers and the New York Giants, and we had this wonderful, wonderful time. And he said, I want to show you a poem I've written. And I said, okay, what are you writing poems for? You design golf courses. So anyway, I left. The dinner started very late, and I left almost as soon as I could after the meal because it was right around midnight. I was really exhausted. Oh, sure. And later, Bob Jones, or Robert Trent Jones Jr.,
doesn't involve a man
made sure that I got a copy of the poem. And it's two pieces of paper, and one is the famous Ozymandias.
Look upon my works,
ye mighty, and despair. Right. You know, everybody has been taught this poem, and what this poem is about is that not so fast, Sparky. Nobody's
ashes
forever.
Ashes to ashes.
Nobody's forever. So Robert Trent Jones Jr. Wrote a sort of a parody of Ozymandias as a baseball thing about the Dodgers and the Giants in the 1951 game. I'm not going to read the whole thing because it's very long, but it's very touching and thrilling that he would be so happy to share this and so proud of this, whereas all I would think of is, you've designed these great golf courses. What do you care about this other stuff? And he was a baseball fan. I mean, everybody at that age is a baseball fan. It just was interesting to me. I have nowhere to go with it except to say that.
That's great.
So we'll get out of here. And we will come back with a jingle and with some email, yes?
That's right. I believe the jingle might involve one of our sponsors.
Okay, I'm Tony Kornheiser.
This is the Tony Kornheiser Show.
He sells blue.
Oh, this is very good.
Blue apron. Watches from movement for a fee. Owning a restaurant isn't free. Cash flow stains.
We are getting hammered.
He sells blue apron. Johnny O clothing, MeUndies.
Johnny O stuff is great. You ought to get it.
Shape bomb and razors from Harry's. This show stinks.
That's wonderful.
Beautiful.
Joe Arrow is singing, and the lyrics are by Byron Cotter. That's really, really wonderful. Love it. Before we get into the mailbag, I want to say thanks to the Washington Post movie critic Ann Hornaday and to Howard Fineman of the Huffington Post for coming on with me today. I'd also like to thank our sponsors, Blue Apron, Casper Mattresses, MeUndies. Please support them the way they support our podcast. Remember to listen to and subscribe to new and archived episodes of the Tony Kornheiser Show wherever you listen to podcasts, including iTunes, Spotify, and Google Play. And if you listen to the show through iTunes, please leave us a review. The Johnny O stuff. I did wear my Johnny O stuff.
I wore a Johnny O polo shirt to the gathering at Chad's last night. Got a few comments. And
you
I
did?
Would like to say thank you to Dan from Bethesda, Clark from Knoxville, Tennessee, JB, I think he's from DC based on his Twitter profile, Jenny, who comes out to everything, Jerry Negrelli was there, and Rob Stronach and Bill Isaacson.
That's right. Yeah, it was a nice, lovely crowd.
I know why. I knew Isaacson would be there, and Stronach emailed me that he was there, and so that's good. That's good. Dan and Sarah, this is from Daniel Brady, and right, so I had my Gretchen Wu moment, meaning I met Gretchen Wu at Satchmo's, no Shinebox, no Clyde's, no that place that is soon to be renamed Mitzi's. I'm the guy with the pregnant wife who met you, Tony, and Chad's 2 months ago when we were looking for houses in Bethesda. We unpacked our stuff on Monday in Westgate, and our feminine child will be arriving in 3 weeks. Thanks for the laughs. From Michael Clemens in Louisville, Kentucky. Dear Mr. Tony, you all were talking about how people in Augusta rent out their houses for the Masters, and I wanted to confirm there is great money in this. I live in Louisville, just a few miles from Churchill Downs. Both last year and this year, I've been able to rent out my house through Airbnb for Derby weekend. Not only did my house book up just days before I posted it over the summer, but a three-night rental covers my mortgage for almost half the year.
Wow.
I deep clean before they arrive, have a bottle of bourbon waiting for them, and watch the money roll in. So before you begin losing all your money in Chad's, buy a house near a major annual sporting event and gain back some of Michael's inheritance. I'm telling you that the amount of money that they make off the houses in Augusta is... But these are big houses.
Sure.
It's almost as if these houses are built not so much for the families that live in them, if they live in them, but for the rentals.
Yeah, they're built to be
but
rentals.
For the rentals. From Louis Valdivieso in Baltimore, I listen to your show all the time, and I'm really interested in the full story about what happened when you were in Augusta. I don't get to live like the 1%, and I'd love to hear all the details. Well, slowly but surely, all the details are coming out. From Stephen Goldberg in Charleston, South Carolina, who writes, how I would evacuate. Right, left, second exit on roundabout, right, keep driving away from ocean. So Tori, explain, she had an evacuation
plan.
Do you?
Of course not.
Do you?
I'm already evacuated where I live.
You know, so
I just go down the basement and hope for the best.
I assume that the traffic would be so bad I wouldn't be able to get it anyways.
Michael, do you have an evacuation plan?
Again, just drive north. I'm going to Gary's house.
Yeah,
you're always welcome.
I don't really have.
You do have a rope ladder though, right?
I don't have a rope ladder. And if I'm afraid of roller coasters, what makes you think that I would ever get on a rope ladder? I wouldn't do that. From Myrn Windrow in Buffalo Grove, Illinois. My employer let everyone go early the day of Hurricane Bob's arrival in Massachusetts. I stopped at the White Hen Pantry in Marblehead for hurricane supplies, chips, beer, peanut butter. Ahead of me in line was a rumpled gentleman who was sailing from Martha's Vineyard to Maine, but ducked into Marblehead Harbor for hurricane safety. It was Walter Cronkite.
Oh.
I said hello, and he told me his sailing story, and he was stopping for emergency cigars. Too weird. Those sightings are great.
That's great.
From Will in Phoenix, Arizona. Discussions around AOL and cable TV. Is the undisclosed location the 1990s? Keep up the good work, old sport. And on a similar vein from Tim Cree in Fort Collins, Colorado, who's emailed us for many, many years. Tony leads into a story by saying he has a problem with AOL. Nothing describes the sentiment and the target audience like that sentiment, like that statement. I get it. Jolene Wojcik, you know, I always enjoy all of your Masters discussions. When we attended the Masters, we do stay at a local house, and we've stayed at the same house since 1997. It's a large southern home about 15 minutes from the course, but the couple that owns the house stays there with us. They're a darling couple, and they enjoy seeing the same guests every year, which include 3 reporters, a couple from Atlanta, a gentleman from London who used to bring his father to an hour group. In 1997, they charged us $75 per night. Now they're charging us just $125 per night. Just crazy, and we feel so fortunate. I do have a friend who lives in Augusta who rents out the house and heads to Hilton Head Island until the tournament is over. They get $15,000 for their home each week.
Wow.
We are taking Monday and Tuesday off, everybody. We'll see you in the middle of next week. If you're out on your bike, as always, do wear white.
Where's the cake?
Hits these city shores, and I got a couple $100 for what it's worth. But the Cadillac kids always want just a little more. You said there wasn't a God left to trust after a lifetime of breathing out this city dust in a city covered in city smoke and city rust. City girl, teenage tears. You try to film the bright lights through the darkest of skinny girl years, and you smiled when it all sparked and disappeared. Now a list of numbers became our name after a decade spent on nothing but blame, with eyes scattered and wild while they robbed us blind.
is mine. I don't know, but I've been told that it wouldn't hurt to try.